discuss emerging technologies shaping the future. This includes the effect of accelerating change, the convergence of cybernetics, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, biotechnology, and their implications for society. We explore the ethical use of technology to expand human capabilities and emerging of biological and non-biological intelligence. Bruce Damer, our speaker this evening, is a perfect example of why the folks volunteered to form the Center for Future Salon. It's people like Bruce, fascinating residents of our area, that we wanted to have a forum that so they could come out, speak to us, and then have an opportunity for us to have a roundtable discussion. So roughly each month, we have a speaker, and we have discussion.
Who are you?
My name is Miguel Esnar, and I'm one of the moderators of the Santa Cruz Future Salon. If you're interested in more information, you'll find these small pieces of paper that have the web address for the Future Salon. It has our schedule, and if you'd like to get involved, sign up for the mailing list. There are two. There's one that's general announcements if you just want to find out when the next salon is coming up. There's also the organizers list if you'd like to be involved. Help us pull out those fascinating people, suggest topics, and help us promote them. I first saw Bruce Damer before I knew who he was when watching the History Channel, and he was showing a clip of that just a bit earlier. Bruce is the curator of the DigiBarn, which has an amazing array of computers through the history of computers. And it's local. So the History Channel came to our neck of the woods to show computers from Cray's to Little Pets and Vicks and TRS-80s. Bruce is also the author of Avatars, Exploring and Building Virtual Worlds on the Internet. His company, Digital Space, simulates NASA missions, including the current lunar robotic program. And Bruce is also the founder of Biota.org, which is a clearinghouse for ideas, allowing developers of new approaches to artificial life to meet the folks that have been involved in it for a good deal longer. The focus of Biota.org is looking at how technology fosters artificial life in a cyber environment. And Bruce will explain this a good deal better than I am because I'm sort of flying with it. But his talk tonight is how does life evolve in a digital medium? And so to correct my explanation, I introduce to you Bruce Damer.
Thank you very much, Miguel, and thanks for coming out on a Friday evening in overcrowded parking Santa Cruz these days. This talk is going to kind of take you on a strange journey between where you kind of find life and where life might actually find itself. Very hypothetical. It's not sort of an official government position or anything, because I don't work for the government. I don't even play a government agent on TV. But this is the title of this talk is Will Bona Fide Life Evolve from Within Human Technology? And what are the consequences of this happening? And that's not just genetic engineering or making better wheat. That would be a new form of life. And so you ask, you know, where does life's journey take it? Life space, I call it sort of the biosphere. Those are stromatolites. We'll talk about those later. Cyberspace may be a place that life goes. And from our perspective, outer space may be a place that life ends up, more of it than we know. So 4 billion years of life on Earth, what did it seem to do? The best evidence is that it started somewhere in the oceans. It may have started in those black smoke cauldrons of chemical coming out the bottom, and it was all eating chemicals. The atmosphere was pretty poisonous at the time, so it wasn't a very good environment on the land. And these are some of the earliest big structures of life on Earth. They're called stromatolites. And this is taken, there's only two places or so in the world that there's living stromatolites left. And one of them is Western Australia. And this is a place called Hamlin Pool in Sharks Bay in extreme Western Australia. And what this is, it's like a skyscraper of life. So on top you've got a spongy layer of photosynthetic small organisms, a little chemosynthetic layer underneath like another factory, and then layers and layers and layers of mineralized, it's like rock made by life all the way down. So these towers, you'll support these spongy masses. And your automobiles probably contain iron from stromatolites, because these tended to get iron out of the atmosphere and the water. And they mine them in Western Australia, and there's a lot of the iron that's used in cars and things comes from the bodies of these things. Now, what these things did was 2 billion years ago, if you went back to the Earth and you stood there, you'd need a spacesuit. There wasn't enough free oxygen to survive. You'd just be gasping. It'd be like in Total Recall. Horrible. And you'd fall down dead in a short period of time. But just shortly after the 2 billion year mark, the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere shot up because life was pumping out pollutants. You know, any active life form or life system generally creates a lot of pollution like we're doing. But the pollution of the day was oxygen. And oxygen gets into everything and it's a poison for everything. And the single little cells that adapted to that free oxygen in the water and were able to use it were able to create more energy and they survived. And there was this giant extinction, and the things that were able to use the oxygen could produce more energy, and it led to building bodies. So pollution begot a change in energy. Now, of course, life built all these huge structures and then merged up onto the land. Some people call this the hypersea theory, where, in fact, all the stuff flowing through your blood, your veins, and stuff flowing up and down in plants is actually just the ocean that's moved onto the land to support ocean base. It's called the hypersea theory. There's a coral reef, there's another structure there. And we're in this narrow window of time when life can actually be on the land, because life can only be on the land for 600-700 million years tops, because the sun's getting hotter and hotter all the time. And in about 300-400 million years, it's going to be too hot to support plants on the land. So we're in this little gap. And then we go back to kind of a bacteria-based single-celled world until the end of the Earth. So enjoy it while it lasts. So life space, humans doing the same thing, building structures and changing the atmosphere again. So life tends to put a lot of gas out, not just cows and chili eaters, but tends to transform the atmosphere. So we're kind of in a great tradition. We'll come back to this later. Cyberspace, this very weird creation, sort of the great new medium of the 21st century. Again, human culture. This is actually an aerial shot, sort of an artificial shot of a cityscape in cyberspace called Alpha World, which started in 1995, and it was a you-build-it avatar online world. It wasn't really a game. You went in, you put objects down and connected and built castles and roads and stuff. And this is what it looked like from above at the end of 1995. And this is what these worlds looked like online. And this is from 99. And there's me, myself, and someone else are doing a huge convention inside in world. And if you've been in Second Life and those things recently, it's very similar. That's the kind of cyberspace I'm talking about, dimensional cyberspace. So here, actually, just for your entertainment, is the gradual build-out of Alpha World up to 2001. Here we can take it all down. There's 96, 98, 99, and 2001. So people filling in neighborhoods and building these structures. And for the most part, those neighborhoods are pretty dead. You know, just polygonal objects. You walk past them, they're cool, you click on things, whatnot. But cyberspace is starting to get richer and richer. And here's an example. This is Second Life. Who's been in Second Life, World of Warcraft, all that stuff? I mean, these worlds are getting, Nikki's been in there. These worlds are getting richer and richer and richer in behavior. And I set up the Biota organization in 1996 with the idea that one day the gameplay space or the avatar social virtual worlds would be great places to put sort of A-life or biological experiments. Because why? If you're an artificial life developer, you tend to develop everything from scratch, like the entire 3D world or the graphical layer and all your genomics and stuff. And it's all in this little isolated pocket. But what if your creatures or your virtual plants could be inside a virtual world with people walking around and stomping on the plants or poking at the virtual pets or whatnot? There's a lot of pressures on them, and it's pressures from human minds. And that could cause, and so you poke on the little fluffy thing long enough that it just learns to run away from pokers, and then you can see the gist. And multiplayer, like, I don't know if this happens in World of Warcraft, but you get non-player characters in a lot of these games, and they're pretty adaptable, but they tend to be pretty fixed algorithms. They're not reproducing, and eggs are not being laid, and things are not coming out of eggs and stuff. But the theory that I had back 10 years ago is that the best medium for A-life is going to be these worlds, just because of having, you know, a million simultaneous users interacting. So here's some scenes from Second Life and the original Active Worlds showing these are fake biological environments. These are not real. These are not real. This is just sculpture when it comes down to it. We haven't started to do the real thing, which is to put real biological metaphors into these worlds. It's about to start, though. So, switching. Outer space, another place that human beings seem to be driven to get to. How habitable is it, and what are the human prospects for living there? Well, you have currently sort of the best we've done is mostly get, you know, a handful of guys to the lunar surface. There's Jack Schmidt, who's actually working on a project with us right now, standing behind by this rock called Split Rock because it has a crack down the middle. He's got his geologist hammer and he's knocking pieces off of it in that picture. And you have the International Space Station, this big, heavy maintenance, highly error-prone, costly project to keep 3-4 people alive. And it turns out that space stations are really hard to operate. We're learning a lot more about how difficult it is keeping people alive. So you say, well, okay, let's go to back to basics. Where do you want to, you know, the theory would be if you read Bonestell and von Braun's stuff in the 50s, or you watched 2001, A Space Odyssey, and the early visions, you say, oh, the moon's the natural first place to go. I'll show why it may not be. And we may be deceiving ourselves. So we just automatically assume the moon's in the sky. We're going to go there. Guys have gone there before. It was easy. Therefore, we go there again. Well, if you want to go to the moon for 3 days, you do it Apollo style, which is, of course, what our president and our great NASA administration is doing again, is trying to do again, which I think is a mistake. But we'll come back to that later. What you have to do, if you're going to go to the moon, you realize the moon is a harsh mistress. It's a very, very tough environment. One of the problems of the moon is temperature. So if you put a thermometer on the lunar surface sitting on the ground, you would watch the temperature go up into the 250, 300 degrees, baking heat, and then the sun sets and you get 14 days a night and it's plummeting down to 100 below zero, 150 below zero, just plummeting down. The Russians discovered how hard it was because they put two lunar rovers that were operated with joysticks on Earth on the lunar surface, and they had to close them down in the lunar winter or the lunar night and keep them warm just so they could survive that 14-day deep freeze and then open up the panels and get it all going again. And one of them lasted just over a year. It was incredible. It was mid-70s Soviet technology, but really hard. So the Apollo astronauts are like, okay, guys, we can only go to the moon on these days of the month because it'll be 50 degrees Fahrenheit on the ground. When we leave, it'll be 65. We got to get out of there because it's going to cook you alive. Because those guys, the lunar suits didn't have great big refrigerator units on them. You know, and basically they got in and got out when it was just the right temperature. So that's one of the terrible things about being on the moon. And so you do that in the 60s, you get in, get out, and you hope that no one gets killed in the missions and no one did. It's just a minor miracle. But, so if you want to go back to the moon for real, you've got to learn how to dig. So this is one of the things that digs. It's called a bucket wheel excavator, and it's a little miniature one made at Colorado School of Mines, and it digs stuff and puts it in this auger and drops the material out the back. And we did a simulation of that working in a simulated lunar environment. And why do you dig? Because you want to try to find ice. You want to find materials that you can make into rocket fuel, so you don't have to carry everything with you. You can make a refueling depot. And you also want to build a habitat with soil over it. And why do you do that? So that the habitat doesn't go through this temperature ups and downs. And the guys don't get killed when there's a big sun radiation event. You need 9 feet. The computation currently is 9 feet of material to shield them from what's called a coronal mass ejection event. Huge amount of material. So you got to learn how to do that. So one of the things that we did last year was we were part of an exercise to design a lunar ice explorer, which would drill. Wasn't even an excavator, it was a drill. So we went to a place down in called Jet Propulsion Lab, and I picked up this globe of the moon. It's kind of funny, I picked this thing up And because the little metal button on the end of it covered over the crater we were actually trying to go to, the Shackleton crater, which is right there. So it's dead on the pole. And this is the room you sit in. It's called Team X. And if you sit at this workstation, you're propulsion. And if you sit at this station, you're systems. And you basically can't leave until you've come up with a design for a mission. At the end of the week, you've got your mass, what booster you're going to use, the budget, the fuel, the power plant, everything, the locomotion and everything, and you propose it to NASA headquarters, and they may or may not fund the mission. This is for the internal civil service. And there's a guy here who pulls together these simple CAD models, and we work with him, and we actually do drivable rovers, which I'll show you in a bit. And this is the mission. Drive down the bottom of a crater like Dawes and go around and drill at locations looking for ice. This is a guy named Red Whitaker from Carnegie Mellon who came in, waved his hands, and said we didn't know anything about what we were talking about. Because this is the guy who's designed more robots than anyone on the planet, pretty much. And this is what we came up with. And we built a simulator of it. And I'll actually run the simulator right now. Okay, here we are. You can't really see it, unfortunately. It's so bright in here, but I'll just drive off the platform there. And you can see we're kicking up some dust. We'll drive right up to the crater rim. You can kind of see that the vehicle's in a little bit of shadow. Put the parking brake on. Take off the chase camera, and let's send it over the edge. So we're sending it over the edge of a crater where it's not supposed to drive. You can see the wheels turning? Okay, get it over here. Look. Okay, it's gonna. Oh, it didn't make it. Okay, keep going. Go, go, go. So this is an actual. I can run this with a joystick too. Here it goes. Oh, good. You're gonna see it go down. I gotta stop it before it tips over on that rock down there. This is a slope you'd never drive on, ever, because you'd tip the vehicle over. You'd lose control of it. So let's go down to the bottom. There it comes here. I'm going to get back on it. Okay, we're back. I just almost tipped it upside down. I'm going to just ride it for a bit. So this is an example of a design simulation of a lunar rover. So here we go. And it helps the government sort of determine whether these missions will work, you know, before they do what's called a request for proposal. So. And it's a fun little vehicle. Let's go and see it climb a rock. There's a rock. It's coming up to. It's going to try to climb that rock. Now, if we can raise and lower it. See that? Let's try to go across this rock. This has got way too much power. The normal power of these vehicles is, we'll take the boost off of it. Try to back it up. Yeah, that's the what the power would be. There's all these are little obstructions here that if you go over them at just the right angle, you get caught on the bottom. And some of the wheels are in the air. It's like a tank trap. It's called a high centering hazard. So this is sort of a virtual, like a nightmare lunar traverse yard. So this gives you an idea of the kind of work that we do. So we'll go back to, here we're back to this. So there we are in a little crater, and those you can get caught in as well. We do other kinds of work. This is a human lander simulation that we did for Johnson Space Center. And this is a microsat lander, lightweight lunar landers. So pulling this all together, what you actually find out is that the moon is a hard place for people to go. And in fact, most of space is a really difficult place to keep human beings alive, which forces you back to a question of, is the human being the perfect organism, or even any kind of a suitable organism, to live off of the Earth in the next 100 years or next 200 years? And you might conclude that no, because we need magazines, entertainment, toilets, all kinds of stuff. We need megatonnage of infrastructure to keep us happy and healthy. In fact, what you're actually seeing is that the prostheses of human beings, the Mars exploration rovers of Mars, Cassini and everything out in the outer solar system. We won't be out in the outer solar system for hundreds of years, probably at the rate we're going, but we have eyes and ears out there. we're pretty good at doing that. It turns out that mining and digging on the moon is going to be way harder than what we can do in the next 25 to 50 years. Because if you talk to people who do this in the mining business, they have telerobotic miners. We show them, well, here's our perfect base constructed by on Earth with just telerobotics. See how easy it is? And they go, you're crazy. Where's the supervisor's pickup in this picture? Where's the mountain of spare parts? Where's all the crap that's there? Where's the Sani hut? You know, because that's what you need to keep a robotic mining excavating vehicle working all the time. They are a bugger, and there's really, it's hard for us to conceive of them getting easier. So the catch-22 about living on the moon is you can only go there when it's the right temperature. So if you had a robotic miner and a crew there, they would be repairing it, but they have to leave. It's like, sorry, it's too hot for us now. Goodbye, good luck. But you need to bury the habitat, so you need to dig. But you can't service the vehicle. And it's so expensive to get there, and the guy gets an accidental depressurization, someone dies, and the Congress cancels your funding. It's just not going to happen. So it's sort of a catch-22. My great Bible that I'm pounding on with a bunch of other people is if you want to go into the solar system, there's actually only one way to do it for humanity, and it's actually bring the solar system to you. And let's go back a step. After the moon was formed by a collision with another planetary object, you know, bad hair day, you know, real bad day. But within a month, the moon had accreted, and it was just happily ticking up a quarter of the sky and high moon. We had to get some water. So one of the theories is that big comets and big blocks of ice came and seeded the oceans. So the moon was vacuuming up asteroids as it was coming in. You look at the moon every night, you see the impacts of things that could have impacted us. So it was like a guardian vacuuming it up, but it let some comets through. Those comets gave us enough liquid ocean, and here you are sitting here today. But so what? Why don't we take that as a cue and say, let's go capture a dirty ice ball, bring it into low Earth orbit, put a parasol on it so it doesn't burn up like a comet, and mine it. Produce all our fuel, etc., etc. Use cometary fragments as our stepping stone, because that's where our life probably came from in the first place. So that's my current pounding that I'm doing out in the space community. But there's something else that's going on that I think is even more interesting. Because all we've been talking about right now is hyper-fragmentary, hyper-vulnerable technology, basically that's indistinguishable from steam engines. The space station is just a pressure vessel with all the tubes and piping and everything. One valve goes and they're dead. You know, one mains line is cut and a whole blackout of the station for an emergency. It's 19th century technology. We haven't really moved beyond that yet. The only way you could probably have human beings surviving is if the technology like the space station can fix itself. So it's, how could it fix itself? Well, your body fixes itself. You know, you get a cut and scrape, hardly even think about it. Within a day, it's all, whole little nano machines have gone to work to fix that wound. You just don't even think about it because it's just engineering that's there. That's the kind of spacecraft you're probably going to need. Very self-aware at some level, self-repairing and self-monitoring. So what you actually have to do is reinvent technology as small clusters of interacting small things. And I won't call them nano because it's probably not at that scale. But one way to do it is through something called hyper-evolution. This machine here is from the early 1990s, and I'm trying to get one for the collection. So if you see one on the street that someone has put out by the garbage with a sign that says free, call me. It's called a connection machine. It had up to like 1,000 processors, and each of these lights was a processor when it was working. It's a blinking lights cube. Beautiful thing. And this is one of the programs that was written for the connection machine, and it was a hyper-evolver. And I'll show you how it works. Let's go back to our window. We've got a nice little movie here somewhere. This is the PBS show. We've got fairly feeble sound out of the laptop, so it may not really show. You may not be able to hear it, but I can explain it. This is a guy named Carl Sims, who's been a member of BIOTA. And at our Oh, and this, because it's quick time, you have to hit your start.
But these creatures are the result of an astounding new idea that may soon take us from the dog level to super intelligence.
These things are evolved inside
of robots like Flaky must be programmed feature by feature. But not these strange things. They created themselves through a process called artificial evolution.
Evolution by itself has led to the creation of incredible complexity. Ourselves, all of the organisms in the world.
So Carl,
this process happened on its own.
On its own.
Can
you hear it?
Can you kind of hear it? That assembled all of these.
What he's doing is he's explaining how
on computers, we can simulate
creatures
the same
started out in this virtual suit in the connection machine
very complicated,
as hinge
very
blocks.
Things
what he would do is put a bunch of hinged blocks into this world.
When he first dreamed up this evolution idea, Carl Sims couldn't predict what would happen.
The
he just gave his computer some basic parts
would,
and let his
just have basic,
go from
the
there.
Basic physics of these hinged blocks, which he's going to show you.
The bodies of these
and then he would make the hinged blocks able to swim. And they're interacting
blocks,
and somehow moving.
The blocks
so
are
you put a little block of food,
joints,
a green block,
bend,
and they have to get near the food. And if they got
the
close to the food, the one that got closest
system.
Fastest got to reproduce.
Which can sense
and make
the
another hinge block like itself.
Maybe
it's a slight change, but not too
and
much.
And the nervous system processes the signals
and
from the sensors.
As a result,
and tells
he sort of put the software
move,
into the thing and said, use all the processors you want, there's 1,000 of them. Went away for
I've
a
given
week,
it
and came back, and there was all these boards
all these elements
that had come out.
But the computer actually decides
some things
how
that had
they're assembled
hockey stick strategies, things that had walking feet.
Numbers chosen randomly by the computer, the
and
synthetic
so
genetic,
sort of
code,
the genetic code,
described how the first simple creature would look and how its nervous system would be wired.
Yeah, scroll forward. Oh, it'll just... So what had happened was he's just witnessed.
Then it was put into a simulated
kind of
lake,
simulated evolution.
To swim.
Boom, it happened. And
it twitched,
all the types of creatures that evolved,
so the computer went to
a
work.
Snake swimming motion.
Using the
there
original numbers
four
as its
paddle
base,
job tortoise
the computer made a
all
few
those
random changes,
in nature had
equivalent
in
to mutations.
Inside the connection machine, just with the simple
it did this again
basically what they
and
call
again,
the body plans or
creating
plans.
A new generation of 300 different offspring.
And
then all
and
the offspring got a swimming test, with
the
best
swimming
swimmers selected
here
as the basis for the next generation.
The swimming
when the computer
compete for
makes
food.
Mutations in the genes of these creatures, it has no idea what these mutations are going to do.
And this happened in
sometimes
1991, and I saw this on the web in 1994 when I was visiting a place called the Santa Fe Institute.
They had
just
anymore.
Got a thing called
but
Mosaic, a web browser,
might actually
installed on their
the
machines,
motion.
And they were downloading these MPEG files.
So from the original
it.
Creature,
and that's what started me on the whole biota
over generations.
I'll take questions at the end.
All without any human intervention.
So here's all the forms that evolved. And basically what Carl would look inside the code is the code code directly
in the end,
graphs.
This was the best
it was a huge
swimmer
spaghetti. You couldn't understand
it. But when Carl Sims put it on simulated
out.
Land,
so here's
it was
a,
like
sort
a fish
of,
out of water.
It's like a sidewinder.
So over subsequent generations, the mutation and selection process had a new goal, to walk.
So there's a walking goal, there was a swimming goal, and then gravity was introduced in physics with the ground plane, and then the thing started to figure out how to walk better and
after
better and better.
After 15 generations, this was the champion.
A champion walker. But there were better walkers than this.
Other computer runs have produced even better
walkers. The simple
walker,
but fast. Probably can't turn. And the rower, the swimmers. For all you ex-rowers. That's the they call that the gorilla.
Sometimes these evolving creatures would think
now,
of
these are all
solutions.
Fossils now because you can't run
goal,
them anymore. The machines are all gone, so they're kind
expected.
Of virtual fossils.
In this one example, the creatures got taller and taller and taller
this is a,
and would simply fall over. Instead of
yeah.
figuring out some clever way of walking, they would
yeah, so
fall
it's a falling,
to generate
rolling
horizontal
creature.
Velocity. What I was telling them to do was to just move, and falling was a perfectly good solution as far as they're concerned. So this creature specialized in falling for as long as it possibly could, including doing a complete somersault.
Complete somersaulting.
The strength of artificial evolution is that it comes up with solutions that computer programmers
so
could never
swimmers.
Imagine.
It was several months.
Did they ever get them to compete against each other?
Yeah, in fact, I could show you a video. You want to see the competing?
Yeah.
Okay. I forgot to put it on this machine. It's on the biota site. That's an incentive to go to the biota site. So, okay. there's plenty of other work. There's a guy named Gerald DeYoung who's done an incredible project called Darwin at Home, which was launched in concert with Biota last year. And Darwin at Home, and if I have time, I'll show you some of his creatures. Actually, I think I do have time.
You can find the Biota site link from the site.
So here's Darwin at Home. See if it... Because this is QuickTime, it doesn't know how to start playing. Did I hit space bar? Oh, dear.
Darwin at Home invites you into the algorithm.
It may not be able to ever set up the image, but there we go.
Evolution.
So now Darwin at Home, you saw it momentarily here. It's having trouble. Darwin at Home actually runs on the net in Java.
Survival of the fittest.
So it doesn't need a 1,000 processor machine. It's never going to be able to set up the image. So there it is.
Natural selection.
It's beautifully done. In fact, he's got these whole planets that have creatures walking around on them, and you can set them up yourself.
Competition.
Okay, so that's...
It's much prettier than the blue
screen. Oh, that's... This is the new version of the blue screen of death, which I haven't seen in a long time. Wow. Just driving a projector, folks. You know why? This is the beta version of QuickTime, which finally supports 3D, 2D hardware rendering for video. So this is Apple's fault. It is. Anyway, so that was. Well, I'll try to reboot while I keep talking. But what's going on here is something interesting. It's a whole new approach, because what if you could create a simulated world, kind of like we do with the rovers on the moon, but say evolve some rover designs instead of, well, the civil service believes only six-wheeled rocker bogey things will ever work. No, well, you say, that's because you're worried about things failing, which they should be, but let's start evolving. Let's evolve 50 different designs. What if you for 50 years evolved smaller and smaller and smaller virtual creatures or virtual machines that would maybe be on a simulated asteroid surface or a simulated lunar surface, and you even simulated the horrible lunar dust that cuts everything apart, or you simulated asteroids that are made out of chunks of ice and methane and stuff, and your little virtual creatures that were built by gamers, or you know, who better, started to learn how to communicate and eat the asteroids. Like the stromatolites sort of ate the atmosphere and regurgitated it. And what if those creatures, then you said, well, you know what, in truth, if you actually made a creature like that and put it out on a real ice ball in the solar system, it would just die. It would never be able to work. So you get a better and better idea of what an ice ball in the solar system is like, and you simulate that better. And you simulate it better and better and better. And then you build a little machine that can take those creatures and actually make them. You know, instead of like somebody just putting them together by hand, you have a fabricator that can make the machines. And you build a little ice ball in a vacuum on a lab in Earth, and you throw them things on it, and you hit it with radiation, you hit it with sunlight, and then things start to grow. It's like a lichen. You can hardly see it. But that's how life started on Earth. And you grow. Okay. We may be in blue screen mode. So those creatures are now growing on a simulated ice ball in the lab. And then, you have the conundrum of they're pretty good. You know, now they're actually communicating. They may communicate by radio or internet. You know, who knows? They're not Terran biology. They're evolved to live in a hard vacuum. They're evolved to live at the edge of the solar system. Now, why would you want creatures to live out in the solar system? It's pretty simple. Earth is like so much square footage, and we're polluting and messing it up just like life always does. But outside in the solar system, you have these little ice particles and ice balls and ice cubes and whatever, and they're trillions of times the surface area of Earth, and they're constantly bombarded with radiation. They're full of a rich soup of starter materials. It's because it's basically dirty ice, and they are actually a really good place for life to evolve if it could live in that environment. In fact, the next version of life that would be appropriate for space, if they could live in that environment, that would be the place you would put them. You wouldn't put them on Jupiter because a huge atmosphere would wipe them out. You know, you wouldn't put them on Venus because it's so hot it just burns everything up. But those little dirty ice balls are just a sweet environment. And comets are sort of going in and out of the inner solar system, and they survived that trip, except for the recent one that went straight into the sun. But those, you know, they can get warm a little bit, and the surface melts off. It's a pretty darn good environment. And in fact, there's a theory that says that, in fact, life, single-celled bacteria are in crustal material floating throughout the galaxy in a great big habitable zone, and they're always out there. So small little tiny lifelike things, now in this case in a bacteria, it's just lifelike us, it's sort of a single cell, but what if nano life, or how would you describe it, the life that came from a mind that made these little robots for purpose instead of it just coming out of a soup. And those purposeful robots, if we were able to evolve them in the lab, iterate a billion years of evolution in a giant computer network, put them in a physical environment and actually put them out there, we could watch something happen. We would actually deliver terrestrial life out into the solar system that is actually evolved and designed to live there. Now, what does that leave us? You know, we put all this investment. They keep evolving. You know, we've let the cat out of the bag. They may not want to do our bidding. It's like, well, we made you guys so that you would hollow out this big block of ice and make a home for us that has beaches and good air, and all you did was evolve and you did something else. It's like, sorry, you know, because we couldn't communicate with them. They're like a mold, you know, an adaptable mold. They don't know. They just evolved that, you know, to be in the environment better. On the other hand, they may be the tool that we use to get out of the biosphere. But it will be a partnership thing, because it will be just like here, where you have an argument with a piece with growing wheat, saying, please don't be susceptible to the rust, because our whole civilization will die if you don't grow a new crop. There's a kind of a deal going on there that we make, that we trust that the life around it, the life forms are going to work with us rather than be, you know, fail to work with us. So, sort of in conclusion, this may be, and it may be that we'll never get here, that we're going to burn up all our fossil fuels and wreck the atmosphere and everything, and this will only be in a vision or a dream for a short period of time. But I'm convinced that this is the approach that we would actually have to take. But it's a partnership of saying, let's try to evolve life in the chrysalis of cyberspace. Let's put it out in the real world. It'll fall over, it'll die, it'll burn up. Keep doing, and it's a 50-year project. But when it's all said and done, you now have something in the solar system. You have a living matrix in the solar system that you have to learn how to work with. It may support human life, it may not support human life. If the Earth got hit by an asteroid, it may be the only surviving life that came from Earth, for example. But in the bigger and broader picture outside of that, at the end of time, when the universe has sort of run out of steam, there's a couple of theories. One is the universe is going to expand and kind of evaporate. And you won't see any stars or galaxies because they'll be burned out, and they'll be so separated by such a distance that there's, you know, it's just sort of evaporate, or that somehow it'll come back down for a big crunch. You have to think that if the universe is crammed full of life, maybe it's simple forms, that one day that life is going to somehow connect and start all communicating and say, hey, this is a raw deal. We don't want to have the whole thing just evaporate and it get all cold. You know, our radio signals can't reach each other. We also don't want to have the whole thing come crashing down in a big crunch and have everything we've done, all the investments we've made, to go up in smoke. So at that period of time, the life in the universe actually has to start cooperating and not fighting, you know, the eternal problem of living organisms, especially organisms like us, and figure out how to kind of create a single conscious entity in the universe. And that's a topic for another talk. But one of the interesting things is, and this will leave you with this final thought, is we're living in a gas bubble. You know, the ocean is another kind of a thicker gas, but it seems as though when you're an embryo, you're an egg or you're an embryo, you're also in a little gas bubble. And a friend of mine who actually was part of the Biota Conference series wrote a big book, a big fat scientific text on seeing these little sonic waves that emanate when you're in the blastulous stage and you're just a few cells, like 64 cells, and it seems to be things are vibrating and shaking all the time. Because they've always wondered, you know, what happened? what tells the cells at this end of this ball of cells that it's the head, and what tells those that it's the tail? Well, it's some mysterious force, right? That's the ultimate in force. Well, it turns out that there's all these resonances and vibrations going on back and forth that are the initial message. It's almost like the beginning of the universe itself. What starts that? Well, God or accident or who knows? But it seems as though vibration across a medium is really important. The Earth, you know, I'm talking to you because of vibration across the medium. We can be together because of that. In the early birth of the universe, when the universe actually went through a phase when it was all big gas, one big ball of gas, and everything was a giant roaring voice. The whole, in fact, the structure of the universe, when you look at it in the sky with these background radiation explorers, they could see all these tendrils and stuff. That's supposedly the pattern left by the giant vibrations during the gas ball phase of the universe as it was expanding. Then it went quiet. So it seemed to me, and this is my theory, which is mine, but if you're Python fans, as the universe comes crashing back down, say life said, we don't like the raw deal of just evaporating and getting big, and so we're going to turn it around, we're going to have the whole thing come back in a crunch. But the problem is, of course, you get back to that crunch, you'll re-enter the gas ball phase. When you do that, this is aha. We have something they didn't have at the birth of the universe. We have communications and intelligence and whatever. And when we're in the gas ball phase, it allows us to talk to every sentient organism in the ball. And they don't have much time, though. So the gas ball phase is going to last a very short period of time. So all these little nano creatures and whatever and anything that came out of Earth that we somehow managed will be part of this deal in the future. And so they're all talking. They're saying, well, we're all talking again, or we never talked before, but we emerged. We emerged during the birth of the universe. Hello, how are you? You know, have you having a nice time so far? And but we only had like a month before we're all crushed down to nothing. So what are we going to do about it? So they start talking and, well, do we want to save this show or not as we crunch down to the big collapse? Yeah, let's save it. You know, why not? If they're all New Yorkers, they'll say, why the heck? Why the fuck not save this show? Anyway, so then they start fighting and whatever. They have to overcome the fight. And as the universe is crunching down, this is a very wild theory, they'll find out that the only way to save the show is that if they throw off all their own individuality and all the originality of their own civilization, their own culture and biases, and create a single being that can control all the matter. So they create this being which is like a baby being born in an embryo. It's like an embryo, it's vibrational. The baby is suddenly born out of all the ancestors, but it has no clue what's going on. So it's this super happy being, because babies always are super happy because they think they're the center of the universe. This baby will be the center of the universe. This baby be the universe, super happy, but it's getting crunched. So it'll be conscious like, oh, I'm everything. This is so cool, happy and everything. And it starts feeling a little congested in here. I was like, I'm getting sort of squeezed down. What's going on? I feel something. And then it'll look back into the past because the universe never loses information. So it'll be able to look back right to this talk at Borders and say, there are people talking about this thing at Borders back in some planet and some gas ball, and they didn't know what the hell they were talking about, but I'll take that information. I'll take that on record. And there was another civilization, and they believe that, and it'll see its entire past because the universe doesn't lose stuff. And it'll go, holy wow, this is what I was made out of, all these things. And they kind of, what are they telling you? Why was I created? You want me to do what? You want me to save this thing? No. Okay, you created me, the whole universe, to somehow solve the problem of annihilation, of disappearing from whence, you know, the universe came as a bang, it's going to go disappear. And so this baby thing has to figure out how to do it. And there's actually only a few ways it can, but it can move the entire mass and energy of the universe. It's actually going to be, it's only one way you can prevent a gravitational collapse, is to start spinning. So the baby starts to say, all right, already, you know, I'll save this whole show. You're, shut up, you know, I'll do it. So it starts turning, because it doesn't have much time, but it can create like a figure skater when they're turning. They bring the arms and they turn faster and faster. They'll be able to control the rotational speed of the universe as the collapse occurs. And as the collapse occurs, it'll get faster and faster. And if it does it just right, it will cause an elongation and a splitting of the two hunks of the matter of the universe. Just perfect, like a cell, like cells dividing. and then there would be two chunks. Now it's no longer one being, no longer one baby, but that's the deal. If you want to save yourself from the ultimate crunch, that's the deal. It'll have to do it again and spin and do it again, and it'll become a blast. It'll become like the cells that you are, the 64. It'll be 32, and then it'll be 64 chunks and whatever, and these chunks are spinning and spinning, and it's like, they're still too big, you know. Split them again, because we got to save enough matter that the whole thing won't just keep going crunch. And we got to spread ourselves out, and you get a Big Bang, a new Big Bang. It's a different kind of a Big Bang. So that's the kind of, I told you the talk would take you a long distance, but that's, and what happens after that, who knows. But it's now no longer an individual, it's a community. It's mostly conscious this time. It's mostly living matter. Rather than the last time. And what does it do? Who knows? But anyway, something to think about.